Well, the story of Cain and Abel is one of the best-known stories in the Bible. It has provided inspiration for artists and for writers. The story has entered our language. Who does not know the phrase, "Am I my brother's keeper?" From the story has sprung the idiom, "Raising Cain," which in turn has generated and inspired further movies and songs. John Steinbeck used the story of Cain and Abel as the organizing motif for his great novel, East of Eden, spinning the story out to nearly 800 pages. And yet, the original is very brief, just 16 verses. But those 16 verses are a masterful piece of writing. And so much is covered in these 16 verses that we will spend 3 weeks on them. Now, you may wonder how we can spend 3 weeks on this story. And I'm wondering how I'll be able to cover this story in only 3 weeks. When earlier this year I mapped out this series of four sermons, I allocated just 1 week to the story of Cain and Abel, and then in subsequent months increased it to two, and then to three. And then this week I found that, writing my sermon, I'm only going to cover half of the amount that I thought I was going to cover. So that's why the title on the cover of the bulletin is not what you see on the screen. Now, this is a story about two brothers, but they aren't just any brothers. These are the very first two brothers. And furthermore, they are archetypal brothers, representative of two ways of living life. In the previous chapter, the Lord had announced that he would place enmity between the serpent and the woman, between the serpent's seed and the woman's seed. Henceforth, there would be two seeds, the serpent's seed, through whom Satan would work out his evil, destructive purposes on earth, and the woman's seed, through whom God will work out his good, constructive purposes on earth. And these next several chapters of Genesis show us the contrast and interaction between these two seeds. Cain and Abel are brothers, the offspring of the same parents. The narrative does everything possible to present them side by side as brothers. But at a certain point, they take different directions. Physically, they are the same seed, but spiritually, they are different seeds. And they are archetypal of these two seeds. This is why this story has so much power today, and it's inspired so much reflection. This short story still speaks volumes today. In Steinbeck's East of Eden, three characters are discussing this story of Cain and Abel. Says one of them, "No story has power, nor will it last, unless we feel in ourselves that it is true, and true of us." Says another, "Two stories have haunted us and followed us from our beginning. We carry them along with us like invisible tales, the story of original sin and the story of Cain and Abel." And then of the latter, he says, "Such a little story to have made so deep a wound." We live in a very different environment than Cain and Abel, but as Steinbeck knew, their ancient story still speaks to us because it rings true. And in terms of good and evil, our environments are not so very different. Now, the first people to whom this story spoke were the Israelites. These early chapters of Genesis are their prehistory, showing what the world was like before God called Abraham to be the father of a new nation. They show what life was like when lived east of Eden. Living east of Eden, humanity sank ever deeper into evil as the serpent's seed multiplied. Cain killed Abel. The sons of God took the daughters of man for wife, resulting in the Nephilim. And humanity concentrated its evil in building the Tower of Babel. These stories were all the backdrop for the call of Abraham. God allowed evil to spread, but only up to a certain point. And then he stepped in by calling Abraham to begin a new society, a society of the woman's seed who were to live life according to God's design. And the story of Cain and Abel was intended to be archetypal for Israel, showing the way of life to imitate and the way of life to avoid. The story remains archetypal for us today, who are spiritually the descendants of Abraham. Cain and Abel still speak. The New Testament tells us that it was by faith Abel still speaks, even though he is dead, and warns us, do not be like Cain. Now, the framework of chapter 4 is a genealogy. It begins in verse 1 with the birth of Cain, resumes in verse 17 with the birth of Cain's descendants, and concludes with the birth of Seth. In between, the genealogy is interrupted twice with the stories of Cain and Abel and of Lamech. And in biblical genealogies, it's always worth paying special attention to what is inserted into them. And we're going to see this again whenever we get to chapters 5 and 10. So the story opens with a brief genealogy. Verse 1. Adam made love to his wife Eve, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Cain. She said, with the help of the Lord, I have brought forth a man. Later she gave birth to his brother Abel. Adam knew his wife Eve. A generation ago, the NIV helped us with that idiom, rendering it that Adam lay with his wife. And the TNIV has now gone a step further for today's generation. Adam made love to his wife. And as a result, Eve conceived and bore a son. The very first human ever conceived and born. In the previous chapter, Adam had named his wife Eve, Chava, meaning living, because she would become the mother of all of the living. And God, through his grace, allows life to continue among a humanity that is now subject to death. And this life is procreated through the physical intimacy of a man knowing his wife, an action which also unites the two into one flesh. At times, the church has been embarrassed that this is how life is produced. But there need be no embarrassment. God has ordained such intercourse both for the uniting of two into one flesh and for the procreation of life. Both results are ordained by him. And therefore, they are not to be trivialized by humanity. Eve names her firstborn son Cain, saying, I have brought forth a man with the help of the Lord. What does she mean by this? Well, this is the first of about five phrases in this short narrative of only 16 verses that present great challenges for the translator and the exegete. For those able to read the story in Hebrew, this adds yet further interest to a story that is already interesting enough. Those of you who have read Steinbeck's East of Eden might know that it's one of these ambiguities that lies at the very core of that book. Each part of Eve's short statement presents problems. What does the verb mean? Does it mean acquired, brought forth, or even created? If you look at different translations, you'll see it rendered different ways. Why does she call this child a man? And what role does she see for the Lord? Well, the verb is not the usual one for begetting, but it seems to have that sense here, with the emphasis on what Eve has gotten. The name she gives her son, Cain, is significant not for any intrinsic meaning, but for its similarity in sound to that verb, kana. We can achieve the same effect by saying that she called him Cain, saying, I have gained. Perhaps she thought that this would be the seed that the Lord had promised in the previous chapter. Though Eve does acknowledge some role for the Lord, her focus is on what she has done. Look what I've gained. She, not the Lord, is center stage. But by the end of the chapter, she will have a different attitude. When she names her replacement son Seth, her focus will be on what the Lord has done. God has granted me another child. The tragic loss of her two sons, one to death, the other to exile, will shift her focus from self to God. The birth of Eve's second son is given more briefly. The narrator sees more significance in his being Cain's brother than in being Eve's son. And seven times we will be told that he is Cain's brother. His name, Abel, is given without any explanation. It will prove to be a very significant name, but we'll have to wait for the story itself to illuminate the name. Now the narrator breaks into the genealogy to give us the story of these two brothers. Skipping over their childhood, he presents them to us as adults in the second half of verse 2. Now Abel kept flocks and Cain worked the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the first fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord, but Abel also brought an offering, fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering, he did not look with favor. Having started with the births of Cain, then Abel, the narrator continues with Abel, then Cain, then Abel, and finally Abel, then Cain. Switching back and forth like this presents us the brothers side by side three times in their occupations, in their offerings, and in the Lord's response to those offerings. It's a skillful piece of writing. Unfortunately, the skill was not appreciated when the narrative was later broken into verses. And these divisions were made based on the names, so that, for example, verse 4 contains Abel twice. Instead, each verse should contain both names, with the order reversing each time. Abel, Cain, Cain, Abel, Abel, Cain. Abel and Cain are presented side by side in their occupations. Abel as a keeper of flocks, Cain as a worker of the ground. One occupation is not inferior to the other. Indeed, the two verbs used were the same two verbs with which the Lord commissioned Adam in the garden. He put him there to work it and to keep it. Both the keeping of flocks and the tilling of the soil will be suitable occupations for the Israelites. There is no hint of any rivalry between shepherds and farmers. Next, Cain and Abel are presented side by side in their offerings. At the end of a period of time, they each brought an offering to the Lord. Presumably, it was the end of the agricultural year when the harvest was in and the flocks had produced their offspring. Now, how did they know to bring an offering to the Lord? Perhaps their parents had told them about the Lord. But even had they not, they should have known. As Paul wrote to the Romans, evidence for God is clearly visible in the universe. And throughout history, there have been, within most people, an awareness of a transcendent power beyond themselves. The best efforts of Voltaire and Rousseau, of Dawkins and Hitchens, have not been able to eradicate this. In the garden, Adam and Eve had easy access to the Lord, for they were living in his sanctuary. Expulsion from the garden stripped them of this access, but the Lord was still accessible. He could still be approached. Both Cain and Abel understood that he could be approached, and also that it was not fitting to approach him empty-handed. And so they each brought him a gift. Quite naturally, each offering consisted of the fruit of their occupation. Cain brought grain, Abel brought animals. And again, one is not inferior to the other. Common interpretation, or I should say misinterpretation, is that Abel's offering was superior because it was an animal sacrifice. But the offering they brought did not require an animal sacrifice. Their offering was a mincha, a Hebrew word that designates a tribute offering. Later on, for Israel, it was quite acceptable to bring grain as a tribute offering. How did Cain and Abel know that they should bring a tribute offering to the Lord? We're not told, but their hearts, minds, and consciences should have instructed them to do so. A tribute is a present that an inferior brings to a superior. It is an acknowledgement of that vertical space between the two parties. As created humans, it was fitting that Cain and Abel bring tributes to the Lord, who was their creator. As workers, it was fitting that they bring tributes to the one who had given them fruitful crops and fruitful flocks. A tribute is focused on the one to whom the gift is given. It is given in appreciation for who the recipient is. A tribute is sacrificial. Cain and Abel both voluntarily surrendered some of their produce. A tribute is not self-interested. It is not offered in the hopes of getting something back. A tribute is given for the pleasure of the other party. But in the pleasure of the recipient lies the pleasure of the giver. You see, a tribute is an act of worship, of ascribing worth to the other party, of paying homage to the one to whom homage is due. Our English word worship means to ascribe worth. The Hebrew equivalent is to give glory. The word for glory, kavod, is from the word for weight. So in ascribing glory or worth to God, we acknowledge that he has weight. Our call to worship this morning ties all these ideas together. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name. Bring an offering, that word mincha again, and come into his courts. Worship the Lord in the splendor of his holiness. And the psalmist calls upon not just Israel, but all nations to come before the Lord this way. Our opening hymn then continued the theme. Praise my soul, the King of heaven, to his feet your tribute bring. Had they been genuine acts of worship, the offerings of both Cain and Abel would have been worthy tributes, the one from the ground, the other from the flock. But there was a subtle difference between their two offerings. Cain brought some of the fruit of the ground, but Abel brought some of the firstborn of his flock, and even more specifically, their fatty portions. So in two ways we are told that Abel brought the best of his produce. Later on, Israel will be told that all the firstborn belonged to the Lord and were to be given to him. The firstborn animals were offered to the Lord. The firstborn sons were redeemed. The first generation of firstborn sons were redeemed in exchange for the Levites, who henceforth belonged to the Lord. Subsequent generations were redeemed for the redemption price. As for the fatty portions, it's hard for us in our health-conscious age to see these as the choicest parts. But if you've been to more traditional parts of the world, you might have been offered fat, a big hunk of fat, as a delicacy. And for Israel, the fatty portions were the choicest portions, which she was not to consume herself, but instead offer up to the Lord. For as Leviticus says, all the fat is the Lord's. Unfair, cry some. How was Cain supposed to know what to bring the Lord? But it's of the very nature of a tribute offering that you bring the best. The offerings of Cain and Abel reflected their heart. And so the writer to the Hebrews can say that it was by faith that Abel brought a better offering than Cain did. What was his faith? Well, Abel's faith was a correct understanding of the relationship between himself and the Lord, and his tribute was an act of true worship. Emptying himself of self, he had eyes only for the Lord. He gave sacrificially of his best, but with no thought that he was making any sacrifice, because his eyes were on the Lord. But Cain withheld the best of his produce. We don't read that it was of the first fruits of his crops that he brought. Why did he not bring the Lord his best? Perhaps he was too conscious of the sacrifice that he was making in giving up some of the produce of his hard labor. He wanted to hold on to the best for himself. Perhaps he viewed this as a duty which could be minimally discharged. Perhaps he thought that God wouldn't know the difference. Whatever the reason, there was one common element. Self had intruded into his worship, so that it was no longer purely God-focused. It was thus no longer true worship. He had too high an opinion of himself and too low an opinion of God. He therefore did not have faith. He was not ascribing true weight or worth or glory to the Lord. Now, this intrusion of self into our lives is an ever-present danger. We come to Christ out of ourselves and thereby find our true selves. God puts his Spirit in us to wean us off of ourselves and onto himself. But this is a lifetime process. Our old selves are constantly seeking to reassert themselves, to reinsert themselves back into our lives. Since Friday was the 500th anniversary of the birth of John Calvin, here's a quote from him. This is how he begins his Institutes of the Christian Religion. Our wisdom, insofar as it ought to be deemed true and solid wisdom, consists almost entirely of two parts, the knowledge of God and of ourselves. But as these are connected together by many ties, it is not easy to determine which of the two proceeds and gives birth to the other. Every person, therefore, on coming to the knowledge of himself, is not only urged to seek God, but is also led, as by the hand, to find him. Knowledge of God and knowledge of self go hand in hand. Knowledge of self should propel us to seek God. Abel had a right understanding of himself and God. Cain had a faulty understanding. The one had faith, the other did not. Though both brothers were side by side in presenting their offerings, they had taken different paths. They were no longer the same seed. Sensitive now to the fundamental difference between the offerings of the two brothers and the inner state that these offerings expressed, we should not be surprised to see the Lord's response. Still the brothers were side by side as the Lord gazed upon both them and their offerings. Upon one he gazed with approval, upon the other he did not gaze with approval. It was not just Abel's offering that was pleasing, but Abel himself. It was not just Cain's offering that was not pleasing, but Cain himself. The Lord saw through the offerings into the heart of the offerer. Therefore, it was not the fact that Cain was a farmer as opposed to a shepherd that made his offering unacceptable. It was not the fact that his offering was grain as opposed to a lamb or a kid goat that made his offering unacceptable. It was that he did not have the faith of Abel, and that lack of faith was then expressed in the offering he brought, that it was not the best of his produce. Offerings themselves are meaningless if the heart of the offerer is not right. The value lies not in the offering, but in the offerer. And the Lord saw Abel's heart. And therefore the writer to the Hebrews could continue saying, by faith, he, that is Abel, was commended as righteous when God spoke well of his offerings. Righteous means that God considered Abel to be in right relationship with him, to be living appropriately to their relationship. His offering was external evidence of an internal faith. Later in Israel, some understood this connection between the offerer and the offering, but others did not. David, even after his dual sins of adultery and murder, remained a man with a right heart. As he sought to get right again with the Lord, he understood that the state of his heart was more important than any sacrifice he might bring to the Lord. And so in Psalm 51, he writes, "You do not delight in sacrifice, or I would bring it. You do not take pleasure in burnt offerings. My sacrifice, O God, is a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart you, God, will not despise." And yet the Lord had given very detailed instructions about the bringing of sacrifices and offerings, especially in the book of Leviticus. But David saw that the Lord was after something behind that. A few centuries later, it was the people of Jerusalem who were wondering how to get right with God again. And they asked, "With what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul?" But Micah told them that none of this was what the Lord was really after. What the Lord wanted was an inner state of heart as evidenced by how his people treated both one another and himself. And so Micah said, "He has shown you, all you people, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly with your God. Micah's contemporary Isaiah was much more blunt with the people. Stop bringing meaningless offerings, he thundered. Meaningful offerings flow from hearts of faith. And therefore, seemingly insignificant offerings can be much more meaningful to the Lord than the most ostentatious ones, as illustrated by the story of the widow's mite that we read in the Gospels. As Jesus looked up, he saw the rich putting their gifts into the temple treasury. He also saw a poor widow put in two very small copper coins. Truly I tell you, he said to his disciples, this poor widow has put in more than all of the others. All these people gave their gifts out of their wealth, but she, out of her poverty, put in all she had to live on. Now, you men who are at this year's men's retreat may remember a story, sort of a modern fairy tale or parable told by our speaker, Reed Jolly. It stuck in my mind at the time, and since then I've come across it in Tim Keller's book, The Prodigal God. And it runs like this. Once upon a time, there was a gardener who grew an enormous carrot. And he took it to the king and gave it to the king, saying, this is the best carrot I'll ever grow. I give it to you as a token of my love and respect for you. And then he turned to leave. But the king discerned the man's heart, and he said, well, I own the plot of land next to your garden. Here, I give it to you freely so that you can garden it as well. One of the king's nobles looking on thought, that's a great rate of return. I can do better. So the next day he brought the king a beautiful horse. And he said to the king, this is the best horse I'm ever going to raise. I give it to you as a token of my love and respect for you. And then he waited. The king discerned the man's heart, thanked him, took the horse, and dismissed him. And when the noble was perplexed, the king said, the gardener was giving me the carrot, but you were giving yourself the horse. This intrusion of self diminishes the meaning of any offering we bring to the Lord. The surrender of self gives meaning to anything we bring. Of course, when we surrender self, we surrender any concern about the value of what we bring. It is only when self intrudes that we are so concerned. Now, because Cain was thinking of self, his response is not too surprising. The second half of verse 5. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. The narrator shows us only Cain's response. There is no need to show Abel's response. How did Cain know that the Lord did not look with favor on himself or his offering? Some have tried to read between the lines by saying that the Lord caused fire to fall from heaven and consume Abel's offering, but not Cain's offering. But it's unnecessary to read between the lines this way and read this into the story. All Cain needed to do was to look over at his brother. There he would have seen a worshiper with his gaze upon the Lord, giving himself and his best to the Lord with no thought of self. And if Cain had any conscience, he would have realized a gulf both between himself and God and between himself and Abel. But rather than choose the path of humble repentance, he chose the path of anger and resentment. And in that moment, he was estranged from his brother Abel. In that moment, he was further estranged from God. In that moment, he identified further with the seed of the serpent, an identification that had begun with his choice of offering. This entire scene is effectively captured by Annie Valiton, the Swiss artist who drew the 500 or so line drawings for the Good News Bible back in the 70s. It's there on the screen. It's also on the cover of your bulletin. And perhaps some of you remember these drawings from the Good News Bible or Good News for Modern Man, as it was called in the 70s. There in the background stands Abel beside his altar, gazing up into heaven with his eyes on the Lord. His outstretched hands express his surrender to the Lord. There in the foreground stands Cain beside his altar. His eyes are on his brother, and his face wears a thick scowl. In this simple drawing, Annie has captured the profound dynamics of these three verses. Now, if Abel, with his limited knowledge, knew how to approach God in faith, how much more should we, to whom the scriptures have revealed so much more about God and about ourselves? Abel knew the Lord as creator, as the one who had prospered his flock. We know him also as the father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who emptied himself and surrendered himself so completely to his Father in order to deliver us from sin and death. We know God as the one who has put his Spirit in us to deliver us from ourselves, to remake us into the image of God in Christ, that we might become our true selves. We no longer bring offerings of grain or lambs. Instead, we present our whole selves to God, those who have been brought from death to life, as Paul writes to the Romans. And this surrender of ourselves is our true worship. Both Cain and Abel presented their offerings to the Lord, but only Abel was really presenting himself to the Lord. By faith, Abel still speaks, even though he is dead. Do not be like Cain.